behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show. I'm Ben.
And I'm Scott.
And today we are joined yet again by Casey, don't call it a comeback, Pegram.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah, because Casey, as we mentioned before, has been a longtime friend of the show and was our primary producer for a while.
Yeah, for a long, long time he was, right up until the point when Noel took over.
Yeah. And now he is back, but don't call it a comeback because, you know, with his one big family, we still all hang out and talk to each other outside of stuff.
Casey's been around all along. It's just he's not producing our show.
Right, yeah. Primarily due to creative differences. No, I'm just kidding.
What's Noel off doing anyways? He's got some adventure going?
Yeah, Noel is actually, I don't know how much you would want me to say, but Noel's out on an adventure.
Okay, yeah. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah, out on a completely legitimate, non-sketchy adventure. speaking of adventures, today, Scott, I'm excited about this one. This is one of our biographical episodes.
Sure, yeah. And I feel like somewhere along the way a listener has suggested this, but I don't know where it came. And I have a feeling, I have a fear, I guess, maybe, Ben, that it came from Facebook. And you and I have discussed Facebook a few times, how sorting those messages or searching those messages is nearly impossible.
Yeah, it's strange. You know, that's how we know we're getting old, man, because we're starting to say, why can't I get this darn thing to work?
Yeah, there's probably a way to do it. There's probably a way to do it. But, you know, I had been writing these down in a notebook along the way so I wouldn't lose them just because of this. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe this one got lost. But if you are someone who suggested that we do a show about automotive legends, and I think along those lines was Smokey Unick.
Yeah.
And Mickey Thompson.
Right.
And Carol Roth. Shelby and, Jack Roush and all those guys. But someone also suggested that we do Eddie Rickenbacker. And we're Fast Eddie, I guess, maybe. And this guy is fascinating. When I started reading about Eddie Rickenbacker, I had no idea where this story was going to go. He's an interesting guy with some pretty serious automotive ties, but there's more to his story than just that. So along the way, we're going to talk about the ownership of an airline. We're going to talk about his World War I and World War II exploits.
Yes.
You know, just his life in general had so many twists and turns to it that he's an interesting character. He had his own car company for a while.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll talk about that, too. He had several brushes with death.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Okay. Before we even jump into this story.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that when you first start reading about him, almost invariably in the first couple of paragraphs of whatever story you're going to read about this guy, they're going to say that kind of a defining characteristic of this guy's life was that many times in his life, he almost died. And I find that's kind of a funny way to say it, but mm-hmm. he had a lot of near-death experiences, some that were far more severe than others, I think. I mean,
sure.
As far as maybe more dramatic.
Oh, yeah.
I should say, but they were all very close. I mean, starting out when he was very young. I mean, I can list you just a couple right now before we get to the big ones. But just to give you an example, I think he died, nearly died several times. He was reported as dead to the public at least twice before he actually died.
Yes.
But just things like this, like he had an early run-in with a horse-drawn carriage when he was very young. He had a botched tonsillectomy when he was young as well that nearly killed him. I think that the other one, there was something that maybe it was when he was in grade school, I think. He was part of something that they called the Horsehead Gang. Now, I don't know if that's like a kid's gang, you know, that kind of ran around together,
right,
like
yeah.
an R gang type of situation,
right.
You know,
yeah.
With the little rascals. But, they said that was maybe his first real life threatening experience where, he lived near an old mine and they used to ride the mine cart down the slope, near his house. And one day it tipped over and almost crushed them to death. So that's one thing, but these get more severe as his life goes on, like these near-death experiences. And, you know, being a race car driver and all that, you would expect one thing, but that's not really what's going to happen to this guy. I'll tell you, when we get to it, you're going to find it fascinating.
M. Night Shyamalan could write plots like this. Do you remember M. Night Shyamalan?
Of course. I just saw his recent movie.
Saw The Visit?
I saw The Visit, yeah.
We have to talk off air about that. What do you think?
Well, you know what? I'll say I liked it, but the reason I liked it was because I was taking my kid to her first really kind of scary movie at the theater.
Whoa.
And that was exciting. Because she's 13, mm-hmm. and it's kind of like the age when I can remember in my past, you know, watching like maybe a Friday the 13th or something like that, where yeah. like a cool parent would take you out to see something like that. Now, this one wasn't an R-rated or anything.
Okay.
I don't think. I think it was PG-13. But either way, I wanted her to see a scary movie this season. You know, when she's 13, mm-hmm. it's kind of time, you know, I guess maybe it's like a rite of passage almost.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this is a pretty good one to start with. It was spooky. Big twist in it.
Right, of course.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, normally does that. But so you've seen it as well?
Yeah, yeah. I saw it as well because the trailer seemed interesting. And my girlfriend and I are both fans of horror movies. So I wanted to check that out. And also, it's strange to me that there is so much criticism of M. Night Shyamalan. I get it. You know, a lot of people make... you can't make bad movies. You can't have winners all the time, right?
No, sure.
Cause otherwise it's not a competition, which is ultimately what Hollywood is. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty cool. I can't say much though, cause I don't want to spoil it for other people.
Yeah, that's the thing. We're not allowed to say a whole lot about it. I mean, and plus we're not really doing a movie podcast anyway.
No, so. You're right. You're right. for the record, the first R-rated movie I was able to see was when my dad stuck me in a theater, was when my dad stuck me into Free Jack, which was just this not the best movie. It had racing in it. That was about it.
Well, that's cool.
All right. So let's go. Speaking of times past, Let's see, do you want to start at the beginning of Rickenbacker's life or you want to go a little before?
Well, how about this? We'll start at the beginning of his life and maybe just go from there. I mean, it starts in 1890.
Right.
And we'll go through his life history, but not in excruciating detail.
No, we'll get to the other stuff. So
yeah.
In 1890, he's born Edward Rickenbacker, no middle name, in Ohio, in Columbus specifically. His parents are Swiss immigrants who speak German.
Interesting that he had no middle name, isn't it?
Mm.
Later on, I heard that he had chosen his own middle name. He decided that he wrote his name out, and this is a weird story. He wrote his name out 26 times and used every letter of the alphabet as a middle initial.
To see how it feels.
Yeah, like he wrote his name out and said Edward A. Rickenbacker.
All the
Edward
way to Edward
B. Rickenbacker.
Edward
and he wrote
Z.
All that, and he determined that he liked the look of V the best, so he stuck with Edward Vernon Rickenbacker.
Right.
And that's kind of like his own self-given middle name.
Which, you know, is a thing that I think is kind of cool. That'd be a cool thing to do as a kid, you know, when someone says, okay, you have to hold off for a while. And you have to say, all right, you don't have a middle name now. You either have to earn one or give one to yourself.
Well, this is kind of like what we do with Noel and with Casey.
Yeah.
Right? The nicknames almost. Like, you know, something in the middle.
I guess you're right. Maybe we should alphabetize them. Anyway, he loved machines from a very, very early age, which is something that we hear often with entrepreneurs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that they are born with this love of machines. Now, you mentioned his earlier brush with death during his affiliation with the Horsehead Gang. Right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. The mine cart and the cart tipping over and almost crushing him to death. So, you know, he's like a school age kid, you know, he's interested in machines and stuff like that and, you know, has a mechanical interest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 1903, when he was just 13 years old, his father passes away.
Yeah. Tragedy strikes.
Yeah. Tragedy strikes. And he had to quit school and he used that mechanical skill to go to work as a machinist on the Pennsylvania Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, had to, you know, quit school, had to kind of support the family, had to do all that. But this kind of led him to future employment at a place called the Freyer Miller Air Cooled Car Company. And Freyer Miller, that's a tough one to say for me. That's a type of vehicle that was built by the Oscar Lear Automobile Company. And these were manufactured between 1904 and 1910. So just as he's beginning to develop this machining career, you know, with the Pennsylvania Railroad, Freyer Miller, notices his talent and say that they want him to come work for that company.
Yeah. Yeah. So, he aggressively pursued any kind of automotive related job, hobby, or industry. This is a car guy from very early age. And here is where we enter into one of the largest, most successful races in U.S. history, because eventually Rickenbacker becomes a race car driver in the early days of Indy 500.
Yeah, and you know where all this began was, remember I mentioned about the Freyer Miller car?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so he started racing these cars around 1910 when he was about age 20. So the Freyer Miller racing history, I guess, if you want to go through that, I don't know if need to mention that or not, but this car was promoted as being the car of endurance. Okay, so it was a an endurance racing type vehicle. And of course, you know, Rickenbacker working for the company wanted to race these cars as well. So he did start doing that. And, you know, the racing history of the company goes back about 5 years prior to that. So 1905, you know, they built them from 1904 to 1910. Around 1905, they started racing them. And this is interesting, Ben. I found this little side note. The world's first 24-hour race was held in Columbus, Ohio. And that's where all this was happening. I don't know if we mentioned that.
He was born in Columbus.
Yeah, he's born in Columbus, and really, you know, this working, you know, where he was, he's still living and working in Columbus, Ohio. But the world's first 24-hour race was held in Columbus, Ohio, back in 1905, and one of these stripped-down Freyer Miller cars was driven by Lee Freyer, one of the co-founders of the company. Mm-hmm. And during that 24-hour race, now he didn't finish the race because of an accident. It wasn't the car broke down or anything, but he drove a total of 728 miles, with an average of 2 hours and 10 minutes per 100 miles. So that's about 50 miles per hour. That's about what they were doing. Not bad for 1905, really.
Uh-huh.
But this wasn't Eddie racing yet. And to continue that kind of, racing heritage or, you know, to kind of build that heritage, I guess, for the Freyer Miller company, another one of the Freyer Miller employees ran in something called the Long Branch Race, and I think that was in New Jersey. I've been trying to dig into that. I'm pretty sure it was. But a Freyer Miller car covered more miles in 1 week than any other type of self-propelled vehicle. Now, more miles in 1 week, so this is a long, long race. I can't find out a lot of details about this Long Branch Race right now, but I think it was a week-long race. So they covered 3,202 miles in 6 days, 15 hours, and 29 minutes. And they said during the last 1,800 or so miles, the engine never stopped, and it broke records for distance and endurance along the way. So Eddie right away has kind of locked himself in with this company that has a really good reputation for endurance and racing and all that. And that leads him to the Indy 500, as you mentioned, in the early, early days, the second race that was ever run there.
Very early days. And he ends up competing about four times.
Yeah.
In his first stint. And this along with his other racing stripes,
Not Ben.
Sorry. He gets a nickname himself, Fast Eddie.
Yeah.
So, Fast Eddie Rickenbacker. He joins Peugeot. He leaves Peugeot in 1915. He joins the Maxwell Race team. Then he joins a team called Presto Light as their manager.
Mm-hmm.
And he is racing improved, and then begins to race improved Maxwells for Presto Light. And then something big hits.
World War One. Yeah, that's right. And, World War One, this is right around 1917, I think. And, immediately he volunteers for service. So the thing is, he's age 27. And, you know, being involved in Indianapolis, you know, with the racing circuit, I guess, you know, because he had been there in 1912, 1914, 1915, and 1916. So leading up to the 1917 race, he was probably, you know, thinking that he was going to do that again. But along the way, he had these kind of chance encounters with aviators, people that flew planes. And this is interesting. I'm sure he had a lot to talk about with them because when you think about this, isn't this so weird that the first flight was really in 1903. This is only 14 years after the airplane was really invented. So he's got to be fascinated with these new machines and, you know, what they're all about. But right up to this point, you know, he's age 27. He has no experience in the seat of an airplane.
No, he has one really, really lucky run-in out of all his encounters with aviators. He repairs a stranded aircraft for a guy named Townsend F. Dodd. This guy would later become General John Pershing's aviation officer and be one of Rickenbacker's primary patrons when he fought to become an aviator. And it was a hell of an uphill journey for him.
Yeah. So if I'm understanding this correctly, now the way I read it was that He had, you know, requested to go into the air service, you know, to be able to fly. And they said, well, you don't know how to fly and you're 27 years old. You're way too old. And he, which is, you know, funny to think about, but I guess they considered him too old at this point. So he said, well, you know, I can, the way I thought it was that he offered to fix the U.S. Army Air Service chief's car. But maybe it was that he had fixed it ahead of time and he already knew the guy. And they said, well, we're going to grant this guy a special favor, maybe.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. So, is that maybe the way it happened, that he repaired it ahead of time? And that's it was kind of like, well, I've scratched your back, now will you scratch mine?
Well, here's part of why it was tough. And some of this is based on Rickenbacker's autobiography.
Ah, yes.
Which has come at in a couple of points in his stories. It's come to a matter of like contention, how his father really passed away is one of those parts that academics argue about too.
Sure, yeah.
So we do know, I can talk a little bit about why it was so difficult for him to become a Navy Air, not just because he was 27,
sure,
but also because this is World War I and he was a German American.
Yes, that's right. But he was born,
he was born here in the States,
but his parents were of Swiss and German heritage, right?
So it still takes, that prejudice is still there, you know, and.
Yeah, would he, you know, with all of his heart fight against the German people?
Right.
When he is in fact himself by blood a German American.
Yes. And just to show how important this is, he actually had to change his name. Just one letter.
Yeah.
It used to be Rickenbacker, Rickenbacher, mm-hmm, like Bach or something. But he changed that H to another K, so it's more like Rickenbacker.
Yeah. What do they call it? Anglicizing it, maybe? Or, exactly. So, all right. So, in other words, he gets into this training program, and apparently he's very good.
Yes.
He's really good at what he does. And, of course, I think that has a lot to do with, you know, his skill as a race driver. I mean, he did decent in Indianapolis, didn't do great. I think his best placing was 10th place. But, you know, typically we think of, you know, these guys that race cars like this, that they've got good reflexes, they've got good eyesight, they've got kind of a feel for the machine that they're in, mm-hmm, and the surrounding areas around. I'm sure he had all of that going for him when he went into this program.
Right.
But he was very good at what he did. And by the time, let's see, he enlisted in 1917.
Right.
By April of 1918, he was on the front lines. And I think his first mission was April 6th of 1918. So he went on to, you know, over the course of his career here in World War I, he flew more than 300 combat hours in the air, you know, in these planes that he flew. And he was very successful.
Oh, yeah. When he finally got there. Can we go back just a little bit? Because I want to talk about how much more difficult it was.
Sure. Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So he travels to Europe before the war starts when he's helping to develop English cars for American races. Mm-hmm. And along the way, he gets this idea and he says, you know who would make a great fighter pilot? Me. And other race car drivers, because we're really good at tight spaces and high speeds.
All right. You know, that's exactly what I just said.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. And what do you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm bringing up, because he agreed with you. It's an actual thing he said.
Huh.
And he also had one more huge hurdle that he had to get over when it came to actually flying.
What was that?
Way of two. The first is that most of the guys they chose to be pilots at that time had college degrees.
Oh.
And he didn't.
No, he dropped out when he was 13, so about seventh grade somewhere.
Yeah,
there.
And he did correspondence courses and stuff like that, and he was largely self-taught. But also, he was a crack mechanic.
Yeah, the guy's smart. He was mechanically inclined.
Right, and he was an engineering officer, so he would practice flying during his free time. But his superiors didn't want him, weren't 100% on his team when it came to becoming a pilot, because then they would lose this awesome mechanic.
He didn't have the traditional schooling that was required.
Right. So eventually he says, look, I've got this guy who can replace me as a mechanic. Just let me get in the friggin' air.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. And that's when he starts becoming a legend.
Yeah,
as
like,
you said.
Yeah, the guy's a superstar. I mean,
yeah.
Okay, so here's kind of the rundown of what happened when he was in World War I. His division, the 94th Aero Squadron, often encountered the Red Baron's Flying Circus while he was there. He's right on the front lines across the line from the Red Baron's Flying Circus. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that they traveled and moved along. Now, the Flying Circus, just in case you're not familiar, it's a consolidation of four fighter squadrons on the German side.
Yeah.
And it was led by the Red Baron himself, Manfred von Richthofen.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm saying that right, but it's the Red Baron. So everybody can picture the Red Baron. But he was up against the best of the best, really. I mean, as far as like his missions that he flew. And he was very, very successful. In fact, he became the top U.S. flying ace of the entire war when all this ended.
Earning him the nickname, the Ace of Aces.
Yeah, exactly right. So by May, we said that, his first mission was in, when was it? April 6th of 1918.
Mm-hmm.
By May 30th of 1918, just 2 months after, his service began, he was an official flying ace. Now, to be a flying ace, I think we've talked about this in the past. Long, long time ago, we talked about this.
I can't remember how we got there, but we have.
I think that it was part of, remember when we were doing Audible ads?
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the Eddie Rickenbacker story.
That's right. That's what we did.
We mentioned what it takes to be a flying ace. And just as a quick, real quick recap, you have to shoot down a certain number of enemy aircraft in combat. And that number, unofficially, or actually somewhat officially along the way, is right around 5. So if you shoot down 5 enemy aircraft, that doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a lot when you're talking about a dogfight in World War I aircraft.
I mean,
and in fact, you'll find that throughout history, most of the planes that were shot down by these top aces. It wasn't like, just a few people that shot down one or two here and there, and that was about
it. There were a few people who shot down multiple planes.
That's exactly what I mean. And Rickenbacker, eventually, by the end of the war, his kill count or his takedown count was up to 26. So he did very, very well. That's, again, the top U.S. flying ace of the entire war. Now, just to give you some perspective, I guess, the mm-hmm. Red Baron, which is kind of, I mean, I think everybody can, have heard the name the Red Baron, probably.
Right.
Whatever, whether it's Snoopy pretending to be the Red Baron on the, the Peanuts shows or whatever, but, he shot down something like these are confirmed shoot downs.
Like 80?
80. Yes.
Yeah.
And he's not the top ace of all time. The top ace of all time had something like, I want to say it was 352 or something like that. It was a huge, huge number. Just an enormous number. So, these guys are responsible for a lot of plane takedowns and reconnaissance balloons and things like that. So by September of 1918, he was promoted to captain of the squadron. And then by, October 30th of 1918, just days before the end of the war, because I think it ended November 11th of 1918, Rickenbacker made his 26th and final, shoot down or takedown of a plane, to become that top U.S. pilot or mm-hmm. top U.S. flying ace. So this guy has definitely got some chops, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And this, okay, we'll take just a note here to emphasize how incredibly dangerous it was to be a pilot in World War I.
Yeah.
Right? You are capable in ideal circumstances of completing a mission, shooting down another plane, maintaining air superiority, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what you are flying is a death trap. And the rate of attrition is very high for pilots at this time. The Red Baron, probably the most famous, died when he was, 25, I believe.
Yeah, he was very young. And they surmised that it was a bullet from the ground that took him down.
Mm.
There was a pilot that was given credit to taking him down. But they later determined that, the entry angle of the bullets and all that, it came from below. So he was shot from the ground and taken down, even though he was in the midst of a dogfight with several other people.
Mm-hmm.
One quick thing I want to mention here is that, his military awards along the way, and I'll just briefly mention these.
Yeah,
but
just laundry list.
Yeah, just really quick. He won the Medal of Honor Citation. That's for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty in action against the enemy. And, this is amazing. This shows you what kind of guy he was. He was on voluntary patrol over the enemy line, and he, disregarded the odds against him, and he dove in on 5, Fokker type airplanes that were protecting, a photographic plane that was, making reconnaissance runs. And he went against all these odds and he dove in on 5 other airplanes and he took several of them down, including that plane, the photographic plane.
Yeah, he's got other awards as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, you know what? He's got seven. He's a seven-time recipient of the Distinguished Service Cross citation. So, you know, for various various other you know, extraordinary acts of heroism on the battlefield. So this guy is a well-decorated veteran of the World War One war.
Right. So he becomes famous. And for people who weren't alive during that time, and not many of us were, the magnitude of this fame may be difficult to communicate, because a war hero then was in some ways very different from a war hero now, right?
Sure. And, you know, one quick thing I wanted to mention is that these guys were flying in planes that had canvas wings.
Right.
They were held together with like a thick glue that they call, I think it's dope. They call it aero dope or something like that. It's stretched over a wooden frame, and you've got a gasoline engine that is probably leaking like crazy, you know, gas and oil and all other fluids.
Yeah, yeah.
You got a machine gun that you're operating on top of that. You're trying to fly. It's brand new technology really at the time. All this stuff is. And you're fighting in the air in a three-dimensional combat, you know, situation. It's incredibly difficult. So again, it was against the odds really to even come back from a mission in a lot of cases. Just because of mechanical failure or whatever.
Right. And this adds to his fame. A man who cheated death, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is what people might say. So after the World War ends, Rickenbacker is approached numerous times. He's one of the most famous, quote-unquote, German-Americans of the day. He's approached several times because people want to use his fame and his notoriety to further messages. So they're saying, Eddie, can you go with us on a Liberty Bond tour? Because people were the government was much more active in pushing bonds at the time. And he was a major when he got out. But because he felt like he earned the rank of captain in his eyes, he decided to just use that title for the rest of his life. The way that sometimes people will appoint themselves bishops.
Ah, I see.
You know what
okay.
I mean?
Yeah, I get you. Okay. So here's what's going on at this time too. So it's now, let's say it's 1921.
Mm-hmm.
And he founds his own automobile company, as you know, a lot of people with big names at the time could do.
Right,
he could throw around his influence and his name, and you know, make things work for him. And really, not a bad car that he put together. I mean, he founded the company called the Rickenbacker Motor Company in 1921 in Detroit,
yeah.
Michigan. By 1927, I'll let the cat out of the bag. It was defunct by 1927, so it didn't last very long. But
right.
They built just a bunch of really interesting looking vehicles. They built sporting coupes, they built touring cars, they built sedans, roadsters.
They also had a lot of innovations, and not to am I rolling over?
No, no,
I'm
no,
just
not
excited
at all.
About this.
No,
part.
Go ahead.
Well, they had a lot of stuff that you wouldn't see in other cars. So we mentioned Rickenbackers in a podcast a long time ago, Scott, which was, I believe it was our Curtis Kraft episode.
No kidding.
It was either Curtis Kraft or somewhere around that timeline. Wait, you know what it is? It was Brass Cars.
Oh, Brass Car Era.
Brass
yep,
Eras,
yep, sure.
Yeah. So the safety glass, was patented by John Wood in England in 1905, but in 1926, Rickenbacker cars made it a production feature.
Interesting.
And they also had numerous other innovations, right?
Yes, and in 1923, here's another innovation, Ben.
Yeah.
1923, Rickenbacker introduced four-wheel brakes. Now, I'm not saying four-wheel disc brakes. I'm not saying four-wheel steering or anything
just
like that.
Just brakes on all four wheels.
Exactly right. And I hate, you know, I hesitate to say that it's the first ever.
That's always tricky.
It is tough, but I'm going to say that it's among the first, and it may be the first vehicle that had four-wheel brakes. But regardless, the stuff that we just talked about, in addition to other things that he included in these cars, because they were well-built vehicles, they were also very expensive vehicles, and
yeah.
The sales just weren't there. So, you know, poor sales means that you're not going to be in business too long. However, by 1927, they had built and sold 35,000 vehicles. So it wasn't like a quick flash in the pan, you know, like they built 10 cars and that was it.
Right.
35,000 vehicles were out there. I don't know if a lot, I can't give you a number on how many exist still.
There's still some around today, but people don't, it's tough to get an estimate of how many.
They're pretty rare. They're pretty rare. Now, well, this is all happening. You know, he founded this company in 1921. In 1922, he was married to his wife that he kept for the rest of his life, Adelaide Frost.
Mm-hmm.
And they had two kids along the way. They had a son named David in 1925 and a son named William in 1928.
And it wasn't all bad news when Rickenbacker Automotive went bankrupt in 27, because that's the same year that Eddie Rickenbacker, get this, Scott, bought the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Yes. So here's the crazy thing. He had raced there as a youngster.
And then bought the entire thing.
Yeah, went to the war and then bought the Indianapolis Speedway. And that place is enormous. Have you ever been there? It's a 2.5 mile oval and just an incredible facility. He bought it for $700,000 in 1927. Now, I did the conversion on this, Ben, of course.
Yeah,
and in today's money,
that
would be $9.5 million. Now,
wow. You
may think, well, it's not, I mean, that's not completely out of range. I mean, you could say like, well, geez, that doesn't sound like it's a lot of money for the Indy 500 track right now. It's probably worth a lot more than that right now. But it wasn't exactly the track that we know now either. It had flat corners. The facilities weren't what they are now, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He made a lot of improvements along the way. One thing that he did is he introduced bank turns to Indianapolis. They didn't have bank turns. It was a flat track, as I just mentioned. They mentioned a lot of other upgrades that he did along the way, but he owned this track through some really difficult times. So he bought it right after, you know, this company went under. So he fails as an automotive magnate, I guess. And right away picks up with this purchase of the track and holds on to it for decades.
And in his defense, Scott, Rickenbacker Motors, the bankruptcy, I don't think is really his fault, to be absolutely honest with you, because the company itself happened when a guy named Barney Everett decided to start up another car company.
And that was his business partner.
Yeah, and he had started car companies before. He was asking Rickenbacker for the use of his name, and then in return, he named Eddie Rickenbacker vice president and director of sales.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So it's not a...
He's trying to get on the coattails of Rickenbacker's fame.
Kind of, yeah.
I see. Just to sell the car with the name on it, and it didn't quite work out that way. I mean, the cars were just too expensive.
And it wasn't the car's fault. It was just the time.
Well, it makes sense. And I mean, when I say as a failure, I mean just mean that it went defunct. That's all. As did so many others of that era. So really, that's a tough one to sort out. But I mentioned the ownership of this through many difficult times. He owned this track through the Great Depression. He owned this track through World War II and right up to the very end. He sold it in 1945 to the Hullman family, and the Hullman family are the ones that currently own it. So they've owned it since 1945 through present day. And that's who he exactly sold. He sold it to that family. Now let's see. Somewhere in there. Now, while he's still on the track before World War II, in 1938, boy, this guy must have been doing all right, Ben. He bought Eastern Airlines. And I need to make a note here that this isn't the Eastern Airlines that is the new kind of startup Eastern Airlines that started around 2011, a very small company that has like three planes right now. This is the big Eastern Airlines. It wasn't big when he bought it, but it became very big. He turned it into kind of a national brand. This one started in 1926. He bought it in 1938 and kind of grew it from this small company to a huge national brand where they had 304 planes at the end.
Yeah, because he heard GM was going to sell it, right?
And
then he bought it for, you know, as you said, a lot of money.
Yeah.
I had $3.5 million.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Especially when you're talking about 1938.
Yeah,
exactly.
So he did grow this. And one of the big things he did that would later become a point of contention between him and the president at the time was that he negotiated with the U.S. government to privatize airmail routes.
Yes, exactly. And he really was not a fan of this idea.
No, because this having the airmail routes for Eastern Airlines was great because it's a promise of solid business. Everybody's sending mail, at least at that time, right?
Yeah.
And later, and we don't have to go too much into this, but later he had a clash because under the New Deal policies that Franklin Roosevelt put in, he had intense objections to these policies.
Yeah, he was a staunch conservative.
He was a staunch conservative for sure. And he objected to the New Deal policy of canceling airmail contracts with private aviators because it meant that the U.S. Army Air Corps was going to be flying the mail. And several inexperienced pilots were killed in the course of doing this.
I see. So he was feeling that they were almost put in that position when they shouldn't have been put in that position. It was like killing them.
Yeah, and he has legalized murder is one of his quotes. He also has another great quote from his autobiography because he would tell people in the public, John and Jane Q public, he would say, "Hey guys, flying is great, but," and here's the quote, "I have never liked to use the word safe in connection with either Eastern Airlines or the entire transportation field. I prefer the word reliable."
Ah, perfect lead-in, Ben, to one of the two major near-death incidents that that Eddie had to deal with in his life, I
guess.
So this is going to be the first time when he was reported dead to the public, but wasn't. And as part of that whole thing, you know, he had to do a lot of, you know, business travel. And, of course, he's going to fly Eastern Airlines. And on, what's the date? February 26th of 1941, there was a crash.
Yeah, he was on a Douglas DC-3 airliner and was just outside of Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah, that's right. There was the airport, I think it was called Candler Field or something like that, which is now Hartsfield-Jackson Airport. So the main airport here in Atlanta. And you got to imagine what Atlanta was like at the time. It was not quite as built up as it is now. You know, there were some areas that were farmland outside.
Right.
And the plane apparently went down on its way, on its approach to Atlanta. And I think it was a number of hours. It was overnight that they didn't find this plane. You know, it went down. They knew that it went down.
But they couldn't find it.
They couldn't locate it for many, many hours, several
hours.
Right.
They couldn't. Yeah, they had to spend the night there out at the crash. There was more than one survivor. Rickenbacker, though, picture this, you guys. He was soaked in airplane fuel. He couldn't move. He was trapped in the wreckage, and he was trying to motivate the other people, the survivors who were able to walk. He said, "Go, run, get help,
yeah.
Get us out of here."
This is a plane that holds 16 people. 8 of them perished in this wreck, and the other 8 survived, but they were in conditions similar to him. And I'll tell you that this gets a little bit gruesome here at the end, but this is awful, Ben. Now, you said he's soaked in fuel, can't move, and he's there overnight trying to you know, keep the morale up on the crash
right.
site, I
yeah.
guess, because they're waiting to be found. It's hours and hours. I mean, we're talking like, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours before they find this plane even. So he says, and I'll read part of this. He says, while he was still conscious but in terrible pain, he was left behind, you know, when the ambulances finally arrived, by some ambulance drivers because they thought he was dead. They thought he was one of the fatalities. He was in such bad shape.
Right. It was one of those, let's take care of the living.
Yeah. And he was, you know, trying to convey to them that he's alive. They didn't know it. So, all right, so when he arrives at the hospital, his injuries were so grotesque that even the surgeons and physicians who knew he was alive at this point said, "We need to concentrate on other people who may have a better chance of making it."
Right. So he had he was busted up, man. He had a fractured skull, other head injuries. His left elbow was shattered, not broken, mind you, shattered.
Yeah, he had a crushed nerve, a paralyzed left hand, several broken ribs, a crushed hip socket, his pelvis was broken in 2 places, he severed a nerve in his left hip, and he had a broken knee. And this is maybe the worst part.
Yeah, this is
awful.
This is the cherry on the gross sundae.
All right, the impact caused his left eye to be expelled from the socket, so it's hanging down on his face, outside of its socket, his left eye, but he can still see out of the thing. So they have to not reattach, but put it back in its socket, which they do, along with fixing all this other stuff.
Which can happen.
Oh, this is horrible. So imagine what he looks like, and he's soaked in fuel. What an awful thing, huh? This is the president of Eastern Airlines that he just crashed in his own jet, his own plane, own airplane.
Yeah,
rather.
He's in the hospital for months.
Yeah, long, long time. And he says, but of those months, he said, for 10 days, he was really at death's door. I mean, 10 days, they weren't sure whether he's going to make it or not. And, oh, by the way, one quick thing. He regained full vision. You know, his left eye, his right eye, all of it. It all came back, but it was touch and go for a while. He said, well, he was at death's door for those 10 days. He said he had this overwhelming sensation of calm and pleasure during the time. So he felt like, you know, maybe this isn't so bad. Things are going to be okay for me. You know, either way this turns out.
Sounds like painkillers to me.
Well, you know, I think that's kind of nice though. And especially for this guy who had so many near-death experiences, like to feel that way about it. And there's another big one coming.
Yeah, you know what? We should probably just go straight to that one.
Let's do it, because I'll tell you what. This happened in February. This is late February of 1941, the one we just talked about, that crash. Now, he was 51 when that happened. Just a year later, a little bit over a year later, in October of 1942, this guy, Ben, and I'll just tell you now because the story gets interesting, I'll tell you. He was adrift at sea with other survivors of a plane crash for 24 days before they found him.
Right. He originally thought it was 21, but he corrects it later. Yeah. Here, let's talk about how this happens. So it's October 1942. At this point in his life, Reichenbacher is taking tours.
Yes.
And he...
Well, yeah, because he is offering his celebrity.
Right.
To war efforts at this point, right?
To increase support from civilians, to boost morale for soldiers.
Yeah, he's doing his patriotic duty.
Right. And he is on a tour of air bases in the Pacific Theater to review living conditions, operations, but also on a secret mission.
Ah, yes. Now, this is intriguing to me. This is something that really hasn't been made. The actual message itself has never been made public, but the guy's name is the Secretary of War. His name is Henry L. Stimson. And Stimson was he gave Reichenbacher a letter that he was supposed to hand deliver to General Douglas MacArthur. That was really it was an angry letter, right?
Yeah, it was a warning and a rebuke, because MacArthur, who you know, you guys know the stereotype of generals, a little headstrong.
Sure.
MacArthur had made some disparaging public comments about the administration.
So what I find intriguing about this is that the contents of that letter have never been made public. At least as far as I know at this point, they haven't been made public. But we do know that he was there to give this sternly written letter to General MacArthur. And he was trying to get there. So here he's in a plane flying over the Pacific Theater during World War II.
Right.
On a mission that, it's, I guess, a kind of secret mission, but not really secret. I mean, he's got something with him he's supposed to deliver but no one
right.
knows about. But
yeah.
They know where he's going. The problem was there was an instrument malfunction along the way that led them to be way off course. And, it was a navigation system that was off.
Right. Because they were in a B-17D flying fortress.
Yeah.
And because the navigation was off, they strayed hundreds of miles off course while on their way to refuel at a place called Canton Island.
Yeah. So they did not get to refuel, of course, and they had to ditch the plane in the ocean. And of course, we're right in the middle of all these Japanese held islands that are, you know, in the Pacific, and they're adrift in the ocean in these life rafts. They were able to get to life rafts, thankfully. But they were adrift for thousands of miles and for, as we said, 24 days. Now,
almost a month. Very few supplies.
That's a long, long time for these guys to be out in the water. And, many people don't make it through that. You know, we can be honest about it. They just don't live through something like that.
Right. They had enough food for maybe 3 days on some starvation rations. And after those 3 days, they didn't eat for, another 5 days?
Yeah. This is where it takes kind of a really interesting turn. So, not only is it this incredible tale of survival and all that, everything that goes along with this, surviving overnight in the Pacific, sharks and all that, right? Everything else, the elements. This is crazy. So after 3 days, the food runs out. They wait another 5 days, just kind of floundering, waiting for rescue that's not coming. On the eighth day, a seagull lands on top of Eddie Rickenbacker's head. A seagull.
Because they're probably so weak at this point. Look, I don't want to spread a bunch of seagull stereotypes, but they're not the nicest birds. So this gull probably, probably thinks this person is either dead or too weak really to put up a fight, but they are wrong.
Honestly, the seagull might have seen the people as a meal at that point, or a part of a meal.
It's possible.
Yeah. So they're, the seagull is wrong, because Rickenbacker somehow managed to catch the seagull that was on top of his head. He caught the bird. And instead of, you know, the instinct, I guess, would be to eat that bird, right?
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the remaining people, that, you know, the people who are still alive in these rafts, they tore apart the seagull and used it as bait to catch fish.
Oh, and yes. Okay, and we also should say that at this point, that crash in the airplane in Atlanta, that was the first time that the press said Rickenbacker was dead.
Yeah.
This was the second time because they're managing to survive.
Yeah.
Largely because of the seagull, right?
But
helping them catch food.
Yeah, but I think people at home were thinking, well, you know, they're gone. Because, right. You know, they reported the plane down. It had been a couple of weeks maybe at this point.
Yeah, the U.S. Navy had searched for a little more than 2 weeks until his wife said, please just go one more week.
Yeah, she's the one who prompted them to continue the search for another week. And as he says, in addition to the seagull thing, you know, where they use that as bait for fish food, you know, so that they could, or bait for fish rather. He said they lived on sporadic rain that fell from the sky and similar food miracles along the way. So I don't know what else happened along there. We have to read his biography to find out exactly what those miracles were.
Right.
But if it's anything like the seagull story, that's pretty incredible, really.
So Rickenbacker, always being kind of an alpha male, starts bossing around the other people and trying to assume leadership to, they say, keep the spirits up.
But you say bossing, but you know, someone has to take that role. And
someone has to motivate.
And you do, because everybody begins to give up. I mean, and 24 days, I mean, I bet there were guys that were ready to give up after 3 or 4 days, you know, when the food ran out.
One crew member did die.
Yeah, one did die and they had to bury him at sea.
Alec Kazmarczyk.
Yep, he was a USAAF member, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so can you imagine what his wife is going through at home, thinking like, this is, again, my husband's dead, but he's not really dead. And after, you know, prompting them to search for another week, they eventually find them. They find the survivors. And, of course, they're all suffering from hypothermia, sunburn, dehydration, starvation, almost starvation.
Yeah,
rather.
And this is on November 13th they find them off the coast of Tuvalu.
And, this information that was made public was also, you know, of course, General MacArthur heard about this and wants to meet with the guys, you know, to continue. And Rickenbacker delivers the message. He completes the mission, which I think is really, really cool. He held on to that special message and delivered the message to MacArthur.
Mm-hmm.
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished at great cost. So this is a story that has been recounted numerous times. You can read about it in a book that he wrote about the experience called Seven Came Through. You can read about another book by Lieutenant James Whitaker called We Thought We Heard the Angels Sing.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the last mission that the U.S. sends Rickenbacker on. He also goes in 1943 to the Soviet Union, right?
Yeah.
And
it's kind of a reconnaissance mission.
Yeah, it's a reconnaissance. It's an observation mission, right? He's also on a bit of a friend-finding mission, and when I say friend-finding, I mean that in the diplomatic or espionage sense. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah,
he's
sure.
making connections.
Yeah.
And the idea is that he's supposed to provide the Soviets with technical assistance for their American aircraft, right?
Yeah.
And
well, part of this was touring aircraft hangars and visiting some of their facilities, right?
Right. Yes.
And along the way, he makes a critical mistake, Ben. And this is, unfortunately, this is what this mission is really known for, I guess, is that he made kind of an uh-oh moment here. He made a goof. In 1943, you know, he's asked permission to travel the Soviet Union and you know, aid with these aircraft and, you know, assess their military capabilities along the way as well. So he's given access to these different areas in Russia and, along the way, somewhere along the way in these travels of his, he makes just kind of an offhand comment about something which alerts them to the secret B-29 Super Fortress project that the U.S. is working on.
Whoops.
Yeah, whoops is right. And, you know, it's just an offhand comment. It's not like he's giving them plans to anything. It's not like he was really handing over anything. It was just, again, a comment that was mistakenly made And, you know, they ran with it. They understood what that meant. And, unfortunately, it was a big military secret.
Right. But overall, that mission was considered a success outside of that. Because here's what's happening. People would try to get him crazy drunk to tell secrets.
Yeah.
Which is just the spy game. But he does end up speaking with Winston Churchill about this.
Sure.
We don't know if there was some movement in the U.S. and the U.S. military and diplomatic fields, but we don't think that President Roosevelt ever met with him, which is no surprise because they were not buddies.
Well, not friends at that point, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yep. So
in different views, let's say.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on past the warriors, right? Because the war, yeah. I mean, the war is over at this point. The war ended, what, 1945, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still, you know, CEO, or he's still, I guess, well, I think he was CEO at this point of Eastern Airlines. And he remained in that position until about 1959. I think they said that economic conditions caused him to retire then. He didn't really want to retire. But he did. And he stayed on as chairman of the board until about 1963. So he's, you know, at this point, he's 73 years old, Ben.
Right.
So he's finally truly retired. And he kind of settles into this life of retirement, you know, enjoying his retirement with his wife.
They travel all around the States.
All over the world, really.
Yeah.
They travel all over the world. And in fact, one of those travels takes them to Zurich, Switzerland. And of course, you know, his family's Swiss heritage, so that's probably why they were there. And in July of 1973, after they were seeking specialized medical attention for his wife because she had pneumonia while they were there. And while they were seeking that attention or you know, trying to get the doctors to look at her, he suffers a stroke while he's in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And not long after that, passes away in 1973 from that complications of that stroke.
Right. He had also contracted pneumonia at that time.
Oh, okay. So he had that as well.
Yeah.
And this, boy, we'll talk about something after this, I promise, because this is a bad end for Adelaide Rickenbacker as well.
Right.
In 1977, so 4 years later, at age 92,
mm-hmm.
She's completely blind. She's suffering from, you know, failing health. She's got this really like severe depression after the death of her husband, you know, for the last 4 years. She shoots herself in the head, commits suicide at their home in Key Biscayne, Florida.
Yeah.
So at 92, she commits suicide just because she just can't take it anymore. It's over for her. But awful ending to that whole thing, I know. But a lot of good things came out of, you know, this union of Adelaide and Eddie.
Right. She was also a very for her time, she was an unconventional woman, and theirs was an unconventional marriage.
Sure.
So she had been married before. She was older than him. She was she's a public figure, you know, and an activist. So it may have been a situation where she said, "I'm done.
Well,
I'm satisfied."
Probably, yeah. Like it's over for me. I mean, it's everything worth seeing and doing is done. But again, you know, they had a couple of kids along the way. They had a good life together. They traveled a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in those final years, I'm sure he was an interesting guy. Because whenever I hear him described, he's always described as kind of a larger than life character, like a almost like I don't want to say urban legend. What am I thinking of here? Like a tall tale character, almost.
Oh yeah, like Pecos Bill.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, those two really, I mean, just dire situations that he was in, you know, with the airline crash that he nearly passed away in, the being adrift at sea for 24 days, the stuff that he had to deal with when he was a kid nearly dying. I'm sure that there were stuff along the way, you know, automobile crashes and things that we don't really hear about that were close calls as well.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that kind of stuff really defined who he was. I'm sure that played into his character, his overall, you know, the mythology of the guy himself, you know, it made him larger than life to a lot of people that he survived all this stuff. But for him, I bet that really strengthened him in a way.
And what an American success story. You know, when you hear people talk about an American dream or something, this is a self-made man.
Mm-hmm.
This is someone who didn't start at the top of the socioeconomic pile, but worked and earned their way up, often at great, you know, at great cost.
He climbed the ladder for sure. He really did. And to be so decorated and so recognized for what he did, I think that's great. I mean, to be a, he's a war hero. He had a critical part in two world wars, you know, and all the stuff that he did along the way.
In the world of racing.
I mean, building his own car for mm-hmm. 6 years, mm-hmm. You know, owning the Indianapolis 500 track for, you know,
right.
through some difficult times as well. You know, what an interesting character this guy is and just fascinating. I was glad to be able to read about him. And, there's more to his story than we've even told you.
Sure.
Of course, there's a lot of stuff, you know, some gaps along the way that we didn't fill in, but, I hope it was as interesting to you as it was to us.
Yeah, and we also hope that you will send us some photos of a Rickenbacker if you were lucky enough to see one in person. You can send those pictures to our Facebook. You can send them on Twitter. We are CarStuffHSW at both of those, and we'd love to have you follow us. You can find stories that don't make it onto the air. Every like gets our boss to feel a little less regretful.
Sure. It's $1,000 in our pocket every time you give us a like on Facebook.
Right. I mean, 1,000 Ben bucks, which are not quite.
You know I'm kidding, right?
I hope.
There's no side deal between me and the boss or anything.
Okay. I don't know, man. You spend a lot of time hanging out in that office.
If that was the case, I would spend all day long trying to refine my Facebook process.
Right.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah.
I could retire next year.
Off the, just the Facebook, the Facebook scratch.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly
off your
right.
Facebook kickback. Yeah. Well, maybe you should just buy an airline.
We should work that into the deal somehow. Every Facebook like is worth X number of dollars.
That'd be great.
Yeah. It doesn't work that way.
I'm not a Facebook doctor.
I'm just happy people are looking.
Yeah, thanks for checking it out, honestly. And that's not the end of it. If you want to hear every podcast that Scott and I have ever done all the way back to when we had a different name.
Yeah, what was that, 2008 maybe or 7? I don't remember when we started.
Man, I remember one time I said, wow, we've been doing this for a while, and I quoted a number of years, and you said, no, it's this many year. It's been this long, mm-hmm. and that was strange. Because time flies when you're having fun, and we hope that time flies or drives at top speed at least when you're checking out our show. But we want your help if you're interested. Our best suggestions come from listeners. So if you have an idea for a topic, a follow-up on something, a cool car picture, or somebody sent in another really hilarious, like, limerick-esque thing that I'm going to have to show you if you haven't read it, Scott.
It's a longer form, right?
It's longer form, yeah. And we'll put it on the air, too. Anything like that, let us know what we should be covering in future episodes. You can write to us directly. We are
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.